probably a little bit too much, NASA has sent it to us.
Okay, very good. But, you know, you come across something like that and you wonder why it's on Earth, you know, what it's doing. You know, maybe, you know, you could take something out of it and use it in medical science, you know, of course, you know, maybe find a cure to cancer or something. What type of service on life, you know, for living here? Back to you.
AC2GS. Well, like they say, life always finds a way. Every possible niche in the biosphere that's available, an organism will evolve to maximize their ability to take advantage of it and to grow and to replicate itself. It's all that lovely DNA in everything. It desperately wants to reproduce itself and continue on. It's the closest thing to molecular immortality that there is. And so, you know, life always finds a way, and biologists no longer say that they've discovered everything. Every so often, scientists will say foolish things like that. There was a case 20 plus years ago, when the USSR collapsed, and a guy wrote a useless book calling it the end of history, and he felt that everything would go hunky-dory from then on. Little did he know. But nevertheless, we're finding life in ridiculous places. We're finding it at sites of vents under high pressure in the ocean that are throwing out near boiling water full of sulfurous material that would kill all of us. And there are single-celled organisms that thrive on that environment. So life always finds a way.
Okay, very good. You know, if it was on any other website, I would have just skipped over it, thinking, well, you know, this is, you know, it's the internet. But no, this was, you know, it came off of the NASA site. I said, okay, there's got to be something to this. All right, thanks for the explanation, Roy. Back to you.
You're welcome, Paul. Once again, you know, I mean, I love NASA. I've always loved NASA. I know you certainly love NASA. I don't know. Sometimes I think they kind of play the PR card a little bit too often. And you know, sometimes it disappoints me. I mean, not in this case, because, you know, I'm as fascinated by mold as any person who's interested in mold. But we'll see if this develops anything. Probably not a great deal, but they got a couple of articles written that wouldn't have been written. So I think that was the reason behind it all. So once again, this is AC2GS. We're coming to the close of this segment of my little portion of the technical net. But if anyone else out there has developed any particular question, they'd like to ask it or make a comment, please hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and call sign. Okay, nothing much heard. Well, let me just go back to Frank for a second. I have not read that report about FT8 and the turning off the gain. I could believe it easily. Joe has written in all kinds of very useful algorithms that probably do these things better than the average manufacturer's AGC. I particularly like the fact that my Flex has a iPad application that has an option that you could just turn on FT8. You can set it for as many bands as you want, and you could just click on your iPad every so often to send out a CQ, to send out an acknowledgement, and have it all added up on a file that you could then download to get a certificate. So Flex and the third parties that are programming applications for the Flex radios are very FT8 cognizant. So that's a nice feature. I play with it every so often. Frank, if you have any comments, we'll let the push to talk rest for a little while.
not know the FTA had, Flex had FTA built in. I sort of figured that because the remote ham radio site I'm using has FTA built into their browser app, and I don't have to run WSJT myself locally to operate FTA through their service, which is kind of cool. Another guy just made a couple of radios available online, but to use that with FTA, I at the moment I have to run WSJT locally. But anyway, now I sort of understand why the other guy is not using Flex radios. I think he's using ICOMs. Anyway, very interesting. Thanks a lot for that tidbit. WB2BX, so I'm probably going to be signing for a few minutes, but I'll be back later.
Okay, very good, Frank. It would be somewhat inaccurate for me to say that the radio is capable of natively decoding FT8. What is able to decode FT8 is a third-party controller software for the Flex line. It's an iPad that a German software designer wrote with using API hooks I can operate the radio remotely on an iPad. And in addition, there's a module that's designed to take the audio signals and decode them and re-encode them for FT8. So it wouldn't exactly be the radio, it would be the application for the radio that has built-in FT8 capability.
I've been thinking over the years that if I do figure out a worthwhile way to set up a station here, I'd buy an Elecraft, but that would be a good argument to consider buying a Flex radio if I could afford it. Go ahead. As soon as I get the drop.
Okay, Frank unfortunately had to kill his connection to drop it. He's back again. Well, again, Frank. I don't want to sound like I'm a shill for Flex. They have different models and different price ranges. I have a complicated attitude towards them. They are capable of so much more than they can do it. They could still be capable of that. I don't know. If I had it to do all over again, I would less enthusiastically probably still do it. So whatever you choose, I'm sure you'll find something that suits your purpose, Frank. Thanks, as always, for participating in the technical mess. And so that reaches us into 10:15, time for the SpaceNet report. I just want to remind everyone, as I like to, if you have any questions or topics you'd like to hear discussed, or puzzles you'd like to hear shared, or if you'd like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to review some space-related stories, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Link page with lots of interesting articles that I didn't have a chance to get to, but they're still rather fascinating. The links will be available for the foreseeable future. So any old time, you type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com will bring you the link page. And as always, please avail yourself of Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive of TechNet going as far back as December 2006. That's at amateurradio.tv. And if you need to hear Limark's repeater and you don't have a radio at hand or you're out of contact, then just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com and you'll hear it. So thanks to everyone who participated. Please come back next Sunday when we'll try and do this once again, all over again. So now I bring you Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, thanks for that. And, yeah, Roy, I'm glad I got that topic off the list. I was going to email you that, but I forgot to do that. You know, about that mold. Anyway, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report. We always do this every Sunday night, and bring you the latest on what NASA's doing, what the Roscosmos in Russia and India, and China, all the different countries, and private companies that are launching rockets into space. All the news that we try to put together from week to week, and try to follow them. Some of them succeed, and some of them go bust, you know. We've seen a couple of them completely gone. Anyway, there's a couple of launches that I'm looking forward to. One in particular in October called the Lucy mission. Lucy will go to they call them the Trojan asteroid, They're located near Jupiter. You have these different Lagrange points. Lagrange points are different locations where gravity balances out, and you don't need much power to stand at one location. And there's really like five of them. There's one, like if you're looking at the Sun and you're looking at Jupiter, they have one before the in between the Sun and Jupiter, and then a second one beyond Jupiter, and then there's a third one, and that's the opposite side of the Sun. We don't care about that. But then there's a fourth and fifth Lagrange points are located. Fourth is about 45 degrees, make a an equilateral triangle between the Sun and Jupiter. So it's following Jupiter, millions of miles behind Jupiter, but in a stable location. And there's another one, Lagrange Point 5, and that's located in front of Jupiter. And there's a bunch of asteroids that just, as the solar system turn into planets, you had asteroids crashing into one another, and the ones that were in the different locations of orbit became planets, maybe Venus or Earth or Mars. And the ones further out, like the ones near Jupiter, got caught in this gravity well at Lagrange Point 4 and 5, and they're called Trojan asteroids. And they believe that these things have been sitting there since the beginning of time, since the beginning of, when all the planets started to develop. So we've never sent a spacecraft to those locations. We've sent spacecraft to Jupiter, put Galileo in orbit many, many years around Jupiter. There's another one in polar orbit right now called Juno. That's been there for quite a few years. But we've never sent them to these primordial asteroids at Lagrange Point 4 and 5. So this flight of Lucy is going to take, a dozen years. It's going to fly out. It's going to orbit, and then it's going to use Earth as a gravity assist. That will fling it all the way out to Jupiter. So it'll go around the Sun once, catch up to Earth, and then pass Earth that extra speed, go all the way up to Jupiter. And it's going to go to the Lagrange Point 5, and it's going to investigate some of those Trojan locations. It's got an ion engine. It's an ion engine that's, they have plenty of fuel because, they use xenon gas. So they're going to deorbit after investigating these things and go completely around the Sun again. And when it comes back and passes Earth one more time, it'll go back out to Jupiter and it'll go to Lagrange Point 4. And it's going to investigate those Trojan asteroids and research. And, you know, they have half a dozen different instruments on board, you know, naturally cameras, spectrometers, and all that stuff. So we'll find out what's out there and what the solar system is, what it really consisted of before anything started crashing together and forming our planets. Anyway, that's the Lucy mission, and that's October 16th for that launch. So looking forward to that. A couple of other launches, a couple of weeks from that is Astra is going to launch a rocket. They don't have a fancy name for their rocket. It's a rocket point, 3.3. It's their third put a payload into orbit. They have tried two times so far and failed. Each time they get a little bit better. But this time they think they're going to make it. They have an extended fuel tank with more fuel, and they think they have a shot. It's called Astra. And if they succeed, they plan on launching a rocket maybe once a month, or, you know, they want to be one of these, small payload rocket developer that could do that on a regular basis. Also, we already got contracts with the military, so I'm curious to see if they make it. The more the merrier. Right now we have a lot of different rockets being launched by the United States. NASA still uses the United Launch Alliance a lot, which is Boeing and Lockheed. We have SpaceX, of course, and now that we have the Electron rocket being launched by a Rocket Lab, they now have a complex in New Zealand and also in the United States. They just haven't launched it yet over in Wallops Island, Virginia. Then you have Virgin Orbital, which is Richard Branson. He's flying a 747 and dropping rockets from the left wing, and he's managed to successfully send satellites into orbit that way. So it's good to have that capability, for smaller satellites. When I say smaller, maybe 1,000, sometimes 1,500 pounds. But as small as maybe 500 pounds. And it's good to have many companies in case something's wrong with one particular rocket, you have a backup, from another company. It's good for our military to be able to launch their satellites into space. There's Inspiration, they call it Inspiration 4, that's going to be launched on a Falcon 9 rocket, and that will be in September 15th, and that's the one that's all private. You got four people going up, all private, they never went up to space before. One guy's going to be like the captain or the commander. He's got flying experience, but then you have three other people that are just, going up. It's not going to the space station. It will orbit the Earth for probably a couple of days, I think 2 days, and eventually come back and land in the Atlantic Ocean. So it's a trip to nowhere, but actually they're going to be flying higher than the International Space Station. They're going to a higher orbit, and I think around 50 miles higher than the ISS, which puts them around 300 miles up. So that's the story on that. I'm looking forward to those three, those couple of launches, those three launches. Lucy rocket by Astra and Falcon 9. So let me go on to what's going on Mars. Before I do, let me see if anybody has any comments or questions. Okay, nothing heard. Perseverance has been riding around on Mars since February 18th of this year, and that's the Mars rover. And it's mainly been concerned with getting the helicopter up and running. Spent a lot of time doing that for quite a few months. But, you know, now it's off on its own. It's starting to do real science. The helicopter is still flying. I think the next flight is going to be flight number 12. They were going to stop after 5, but, you know, they just kept on going. It's working so good. But Perseverance is now doing science. So one of the main goals of Perseverance is to make these core bores. They're going to core bore the rocks and the ground itself. They're going to make these almost 3-inch long core bore samples, and it looks like almost 3/4 inch in diameter. And they have a 7-foot robotic arm with all kinds of tools on the end of it, and it's able to reach down, clean off an area that it's looking at. It's got an abrasion brush, and then all they have to do is drill down almost 3 inches, and they'll pull up the core, and they're going to put the core in these long, they look like long, fancy test tubes. But, I mean, they're really expensive test tubes. They have a super vacuum in there, and they say it's the cleanest thing that they've ever sent into space. Because the idea is to put these samples in these tubes, leave them on the surface of Mars, and they'll know exactly where they are. Eventually, another spacecraft will land on Mars right near where this thing landed, Jezero Crater, and it will follow around wherever Perseverance has been, and it's going to pick up these multiple, what's called test tubes, and then they call them cache, and they're going to put it into this whole setup that they've invented. I think they're around 31 they plan on bringing back, and that will eventually go back to where this second robot landed, and it will take that, all of those test tubes in one shot, and put it inside of a solid booster rocket, and that will launch from the surface of Mars and go up to an orbital spacecraft, and then dock with it, and then that will turn, make a 6-month trip back to Earth. You know, now to do this, this landing vehicle is going to be made by the European Space Agency, you know, the landing rover. And the rocket that's going to launch back up into space will be made by Northrop Grumman with their solid booster rocket. And then the orbital spacecraft will be put there by the European Space Station, European Space Agency as well. And these are all multi-billion dollar projects, of course. But it all depends, you know, whether or not they're going to go ahead with these projects. It all depends on whether or not Perseverance, this rover riding around since February 18th, is going to be able to drill all these core bores, samples, and properly lay them on the surface of Mars. This is WS2N. So now, this first sample that they did a week or so ago, the arm went out, drilled a hole, they know that. You know, this is all naturally done autonomously. They send the signal up, they tell the robot what rock they're going to drill into. So this is all done automatically. It drills the hole, takes the sample out, puts it inside this test tube-like thing, it seals it up, it has some kind of a probe. Probe goes in, pushes against it. This way, they know, you know, how much mass they put inside the tube. So, okay, everything went fine. They mission control at Jet Propulsion Laboratory sends up the code telling the Perseverance what to do, and off it goes. Hours later, a 7-foot arm extends out, drills a core sample, and then pulls that out. They take a picture of the hole that it made, and they know it made a hole. It then puts it into this cache cylinder thing, you know, where all the 31 samples will eventually go. And then they have a probe. It pokes in, they want to find out how much mass that they put in there. They found out there was nothing. There's nothing in this test tube. Now they're looking all over for it. They're taking pictures. There's nothing under the rover, nothing next to the rover, you know. Where did this sample go? This 3-inch long, 3/4-inch diameter thing. So it turns out, the theory is now, they're working to solve this problem. They haven't solved it yet, but they think that this thing got pulverized when it drilled. So they thought that when they drilled into this rock, it was going to be a hard, solid thing. And they think that, you know, the texture of this rock, whatever they drilled into, was just, you know, created dust and just pulverized everything, and that's why they got nothing. Anyway, you can see why they're upset, you know, why they got to really figure this out, because you have two other missions, two other rocket launches that have to occur. One to send a robot, another rover to the planet to pick up all these test tubes all over Mars, you know, a couple of years down the road from now. And you have another rocket launch that's going to put an orbiter into Martian orbit that eventually the solid booster, solid fuel rocket that Northrop Grumman is building that's going to land on Mars and launch back up into space is supposed to dock with. You know, you got billions of dollars and, you know, countless amount of people that are working on these projects now. So they better get their act together, and I'm sure they will. Any comments or questions? WS2N. Oh, okay. Anyway, I'll be interested to see how that works out. I was talking about this mole thing to Rory earlier. Well, that went up on a Cygnus spacecraft, and it was launched from Virginia, from Wallops Island, Virginia, on an Antares rocket last Tuesday. And Antares rocket uses Russian engines, 181, RD-181 engines. It produces almost 900,000 pounds of thrust. And they have plenty of fuel on board to put their Cygnus spacecraft into orbit. And over the years, the Cygnus got stretched longer. They're able to put more volume in there, more weight. They changed the solar cells instead of these big flat panels that come out. They have big circular fan-like solar panels that open up and produce their almost 1,000 watts of power that they need. And then once they dock to the space station, you know, they don't use those panels anymore. They do on the way back, but not when they dock. Anyway, that was successful. They launched the space station. And they named the they always named the Cygnus spacecraft, actually after astronauts that have died, and this one was named after Elson Onizuka. Onizuka is the one of the astronauts that died on Challenger. So you know, they'll find one of the people that have died either in space or you know, natural causes, and they'll name it after them. Anyway, it successfully docked to the nadir or earth-facing port of the on the Unity module on the International Space Station, and presently they're unloading everything, I guess, including that mold. And, you know, you have seven people on board the space station, and the one that grabbed it with the robotic arm was astronaut Megan MacArthur. And, you know, that job is complete for now, and that will stay docked to the space station for probably 3 or 4 months, I think, before they disconnect it. They usually fill it up with junk, and it burns up over the Pacific Ocean. Anyway, they've gotten better at stocking the Cygnus spacecraft. Years ago when they first went up, it was like 4,000 pounds of stuff that went up. Each time I hear this thing going up, this is, by the way, the 16th flight of Cygnus. Each time I hear it going up, it has more and more payload. This is over 8,000 pounds of stuff, you know, including around 3,000 pounds of science investigation, 2,500 pounds for vehicle hardware equipment, which means things for the International Space Station that they need, a couple more thousand pounds of unpressurized cargo. We'll probably include, I think they're going to send up more brackets for more solar arrays that they're going to be putting up. And then they need a couple of hundred pounds of spacewalking equipment, more computers, all kinds of stuff. So, on a regular basis, they get a lot of deliveries to the space station. And one of the nice things about these upgraded Cygnus vehicles is once they load everything up, they bring it out to the launch complex to launch the rocket. And in this case, it's in Virginia. They have the capability of opening up the fairing. The fairing covers up the spacecraft. Keeps it aerodynamic as it's going up, and once it gets into space, they don't need the fairings anymore. They open up, and now that exposes the Cygnus spacecraft. You know, what they'd like to do is, you know, at the last minute, it's nice to send up fresh food and, you know, things that will go bad real quick. They have refrigeration equipment and everything on these vehicles, but they'll send like care packages to the seven astronauts that are on board. So what's nice is that when they get to the launch complex, there's a door now in the fairing of this thing, and they're able to open that up. It's right before launch now, and then right behind that door, then there's an actual door attached to the Cygnus spacecraft. And they're able to open up that as well. They put a bunch of stuff in, you know, goodies for the astronauts, and then, you know, close it back up. And so it's like, you know, right at the very end, they're able to send the stuff up, which I think is pretty good, you know. So, and by the way, Northrop Grumman is the ones that own this capability. Yeah, Antares rocket and the Cygnus spacecraft. They eventually bought it from Orbital Science. They were the ones that had this developed in, you know, years ago. But since then, Northrop Grumman bought them up. So that's what they call this one, NG-16. You know, Northrop Grumman number 16. So between those flights and cargo flights from SpaceX, you have cargo flights from Russia called the Progress. They always get plenty of stuff going up to the International Space Station. Eventually you're gonna have another one a couple of years from now. It's called Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser will be able to carry up like 12,000 pounds of stuff in that vehicle. So this is the way we resupply the International Space Station at this time. You know, maybe 6 to 8 flights per year. Anyway, any comments, questions, this is WS2N. Okay. I should let it drop longer for echo. Stand by.
M2H3R.
Station. NASA eventually wants to be able to do the same thing with the moon. Now they've already got plans on sending cargo vehicles. In fact, Cygnus, the one I just talked about, is one of the ones that will be eventually sending cargo to docks with the Gateway space station. The Gateway space station will eventually be going around the moon. That's the plan, to eventually have, you know, crews in there on a regular basis. Now they're going to need food, they're going to need supplies, clothes, you know, equipment, science equipment, you know, is there a whole system that they plan on doing with this? SpaceX is supposed to get involved in developing a cargo vehicle, but Cygnus, I think, will be the first one. And the Gateway space station will be in a highly elliptical orbit, and, you know, we'll be going from as close as 1,000 miles near the planet. It doesn't sound like much. When Apollo orbited the moon, it was 68 miles. That was the height they kept. This will go as low as 1,000 miles, but as high as 43,000 miles, so it's going to be highly elliptical. And it will actually orbit the moon once every 7 days. And most of the time of those 7 days, it will be looking at the South Pole. And they call this, rectilinear halo orbit. The rectilinear halo orbit is the term that they're using for this particular orbit. And it will, this way, it'll always have 100% communications with Earth, and also 99% communications with the crew that would be on the moon, say on the South Pole, for instance. So always have that view looking at that location. So every time they come down near the moon, roughly 1,000 miles off, they'll be able to have it, a lander go down, I mean, leave at that point, and have that land on the moon. And, you know, let's say they stay for 7 days. When they come back, they could actually launch it and meet up with the Gateway again when it comes down to 1,000 miles. So, you know, it won't have to go all the way up to 40,000 miles. You know, by timing it, you'll have no problem doing it. So anyway, that would take care of the resupply, flying the astronauts that are staying on the Gateway space station. But now, what about the people on the moon? All the equipment that's got to come down onto the moon, all the experiments and this and that. NASA has signed contracts with four different companies to do just that. They've been working on it for some time. These companies, most of them, were involved with the Google Prize. Google was going to hand out, I don't know, $20 million or something. At one point years ago, if anybody could land a vehicle on a moon, take high definition pictures, and then fly 1,500 feet away from wherever they landed, and take more pictures, and nobody was able to do that. No, not even foreign countries. No, you know, they, plenty of people. I think there was like 20 companies at one time doing this. Most of these companies were leftovers from that. They just kept them at a cutoff free period. That's it. We're not handing out any $20 million after whatever date it was a few years back. Anyway, there's one company called Firefly, and they're developing the Blue Ghost lander. You know, it has the capability of landing small payloads, a couple hundred pounds, you know, onto the moon. So you can imagine a crew on a moon and having these things come down and land. And they have a $93 million contract with NASA to do this, multiple landings. And that's in development. But, you know, it's not like they have to wait until 2025. That, by the way, that is now the earliest date that we could possibly land people on the moon. That date has been pushed back to, you know, from 2024. Actually, at one time, a few years ago, it was 2028. I think that was around 2015. And then around 2016, they shifted it to 2024. But now, you know, if you listen to me for all these years, I said they'll never make that. Because there was no money, not 10 cents more, put into the program that wouldn't be able to push that up. So I always said 2028 will be the date. So right now it's 2025. But these companies are going to start landing experiments and things now, like 2023 for Firefly with their Blue Ghost. You know, so they'll have plenty of practice before we even get there. There's another company that's got a contract with NASA called Mason Space System. Again, 2023, they plan on landing their XL-1 lander they've been developing, like, forever. It's got, like, a... Their tank, their fuel tank is weird. It looks like a big donut. It's a toroid type of deal. So, you know, it's got a bunch of, I think, 4 or 5 rocket engines below that. You know, so if you had a donut and you just laid it flat on a surface, that's what this kind of lander would look like. And then they put octagon sides all the way around it with solar panels and, you know, all of that. Anyway, their lander will be able to land there very shortly as well. Another company is called Astrobiotic. Astrobotic is the name of it. 2022 again for that. And that's going to land, you know, they call it 100 kilograms, so, you know, maybe 225-pound science experiments and eventually supplies and food to a base that might be put up on the moon. And that's, they call that the Peregrine Lander. And they've had a lot of experience with that, testing on Earth, I remember, years ago. And so they should be operational in 2022 as well. And another one is Intuitive Machines. They really, you know, I think they're the biggest one. They'll be able to carry 1,000 kilograms, or roughly, you know, over 2,000 pounds of, I think around 2,400 pounds of stuff to the moon. And they have a lander that they're developing called the Nova C lander. These things are pretty much all developed, you know. This one will be launching on these ride-sharing systems. So let's say that we're going to send something to the moon, another, you know, habitat or something big to the moon. They would also send this thing. On a ride-sharing flight, Nova C would go on that. Peregrine would go they have plans on going on the brand-new Vulcan rocket. Vulcan is being developed by the United Launch Alliance, ULA, which again is Boeing and Lockheed. They're developing the Vulcan rocket. It was supposed to launch at the end of this year, but I think it's going to be probably 2022 for them as well. Anyway, the inaugural flight, Peregrine lander, is going to be the first one. So when Vulcan goes up, it's going to the moon. It has methane fuel, liquid methane. It's got liquid oxygen, and it's got these BE-4 engines. The BE-4 engines are being built by Blue Origin, which is owned by Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos of Amazon. So there's many hours of testing that have been done on those engines. They say they're pretty well developed. A little bit behind schedule, but that's why they were looking at 2021, but now it's going to be 2022. The Vulcan is going to basically replace the Workhorse Atlas V and the Delta IV. So once that gets rolling, and that'll have the capability of, you know, having solid booster rockets attached to it as well, just like Atlas does. Atlas has up to 5 different solid booster rockets they attach to the exterior of the rocket. And this Vulcan will be able to do the same as well. And the other lander, the XL-1 that I was talking about, well, they've already got contracts with, you know, it's Mason Space System. They have a contract with SpaceX to put their lander on the moon, as well as Blue Ghost by Firefly. They have a contract with SpaceX. But they're also developing their own rocket. They just call it the Beta rocket for now, but I guess they'll give it a name. So Firefly is developing their own rocket. They'll be able to naturally launch their own rockets. their own payloads to the moon, and of course they'll be doing contracts with the science community and the military, I'm sure. Any comments or questions? WS2S. Here's a story we followed years ago, a few years ago. You might remember there was a Russian Soyuz craft that was docked to the International Space Station. They brought a crew up, and one of the Americans that went up was Serena Anton Chancellor. She was astronaut that was chosen. She was actually, she replaced somebody else. Somebody else was supposed to go up, but she didn't go, and so this one went instead, you know, for like a 6-month tour on the International Space Station. So at some point, they noticed the pressure was dropping in the space station. NASA, you know, they could detect this. They looked into it. They closed the different doors. You know, they have all these different hatches. There's probably about 25 hatches on the space station. Every module has, you know, before you go from one module to another, there's actually two doors, one on one side, one on the other. So they closed doors, checked pressure, still going down. So they went all the way to the back of the International Space Station, which is where the Russians are. And sure enough, everything was, you know, and they closed the doors, you know, all the living modules still dropping pressure. They finally found out it was one of the spacecraft that was attached to the space station. I always have a bunch of spacecraft. Right now there's four spacecraft attached to the International Space Station, for instance. You have Dragon attached, and now you have the Cygnus that just went up. The Russians have a Soyuz manned vehicle and a Progress supply vehicle. It was very similar back then, too. Sure enough, they have to find out where it's coming from, the Soyuz, basically. Soyuz is... It consists of three main parts. So they have the engine compartment module in the back, and then in the middle they have the descent module. They call it the descent module, but they use it for ascent as well. That's where the crew sits. You know, you put a crew of three in there, and that's where they sit when they go up. When they go down, and the next module forward is called the orbital module. That's a little bit bigger. So, you know, after they launch, they're able to get out of their seats, they open up a hatch, and they go into the orbital module until they eventually dock with the International Space Station. One of the old days, Mir. Anyway, they realized that there was a little hole, only 2 millimeters. Somebody drilled a hole inside out, and that was what they determined. They could see little marks on there, like somebody was, like it vibrated. They knew it was a hole. It was a perfectly drilled hole all the way out into space. Naturally, this is a bit of alarming. Where'd this hole come from? Was it there when it was launched? You know, did somebody drill it? Probably attaching something to the Soyuz vehicle, you know, before it went up. They thought originally maybe that was the case. But the Russian guy in charge of Russia space program called Roscosmos. Roscosmos is like NASA. Roscosmos head is this guy Dmitry Rodigin. Dmitry is he's relatively new to the space program. They always had somebody else. You know, we've been getting along with them for decades. You know, no matter what the political flavor was going on and between us and Russia, you know, even 10, 20 years ago, it didn't matter. The space program, they got together ever since the Soyuz had docked up with the Apollo docking mission back in 1974. No problem between the scientists and astronauts and cosmonauts. You know, it's been great. But now this guy, Dmitry Rodigin, gets... Well, you know, Putin puts him in charge 2 years back of Roscosmos, and they've had nothing but problems. You know, it's either bad luck or Well, this guy's, you know, he's just a dark cloud. Anyway, he says that
time complete.
This one astronaut, Serena Anton Chancellor. Oh yeah, she had. He says she had some kind of nervous breakdown up there, and wanted to come home early and probably drill the hole in a Russian vehicle, which of course is nonsense. And you know, right away, people at NASA, including Bill Nelson, who's now NASA administrator, basically told this guy where to go, how to get there, but this is the type of thing that's going on now between the Russians and us, which are, they've never had a problem, and all of a sudden this guy has problems, which I'm not surprised. A few years ago, we didn't have Dragon, we didn't have Starliner, which hasn't really made it to the space station yet, but we'll soon. We now have the capability of sending our own astronauts to the space station. And, you know, a few years ago, we didn't have that. And they kept charging us more and more money. I remember the Russians were charging around 20 astronauts to ride on their Soyuz spacecraft to the International Space Station. As the years went by, we had no way to get there because, you know, the shuttle was shut down in 2011. And next thing you know, they're up to $40 million, $60 million, $80 million. Now they want $100 million, and, NASA's basically telling them, no way. You got to cut that price down. And this guy is saying, then you get a trampoline. That's the only way you're going to get up there. You know, it's either pay me or what goes around comes around. Now we have the capability of sending our own people. SpaceX has sent Dragon crew vehicle up there three different times. One time with two people, and then with the other two times with four people each. And then Starliner is not too far behind. That's Boeing. They have some problems and a lot of delays, but you know, right now they're working out the thruster problems. Why the thrusters are stuck in the open position in the Starliner. But once they get it squared away, that thing will be back on the launch complex, launch pad, and back up to the space station. That's what I think is going to happen. Anyway, any questions or comments? WS2S. Okay, we're up to 11 o'clock. A few more things. I know India launched a rocket. Their big rocket. They have a geosynchronous satellite launch vehicle. That's what they call them. That's the name. And then they have the polar version that goes over the polar polar caps. But the geosynchronous one sent the satellite up. We're supposed to stay above India. Look down and, you know, check out weather problems. And unfortunately, it got to the final stage, and the stage started tumbling, and they lost that vehicle. And they're trying to investigate what happened there. So everybody has problems. Anyway, nobody has any comments. We're going to turn it over to Roy, AC2GS. This is WS2N. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good, Paul. Thank you so much for this SpaceNet report and for all that you do. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Like I often say, you guys make or break a technical net. There was one gentleman who failed to identify himself who wanted to get on to the next topic, but it's you people that bring the topics. I don't bring the topics. I just facilitate getting answers for the topic. So please consider continue participating for those who do. And for those who sit back and listen to the show, think about joining in. It's a rewarding experience. So once again, thanks to everyone. I want to remind people, as Dick often did, as he finished up each and every one of his so many technical nets, he advised everyone to be kind to each other. Again, this is good advice any old time of the year. This is particularly good advice now. The COVID virus is still with us. It's decimating people. Thankfully, it doesn't seem to be affecting New York too much, and I hope that continues. And please, I know some of you hate when I do this, but please, if any loved ones, any friends, any colleagues, if they are, if they're able to be vaccinated, please get them vaccinated. Vaccination is the principal method that we are going to deal with this, both in our country and outside of our country. We can't leave the third world without vaccine because it'll be a breeding ground for a new variant. So please, be well, be safe, and come back next Sunday at 8 p.m. and join me for another episode of the Limark Technical Net. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and I will be going clear.
W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
AA2TS mobile.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
K2KMB, WB2ZSC.
W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This